Welcome to episode 62 of Primary Care Update. I'm Mark A. Bell, a family physician and professor at the University of Georgia and editor-in-chief of Essential Evidence Plus.
I'm John Hickner, family physician and editor-in-chief of the Journal of Family Practice.
I'm Henry Barry, another family physician and one of the co-founders of InfoPoems. Mark, I think we're recording the day after your birthday, if I have that right. Happy birthday, and I hope that you did all kinds of fun things now that you've returned back to Georgia.
Yeah, a little bit fewer fun things than normal, I guess. I took a nice bike ride, and Laura and I cooked a really nice meal and sat out on the deck and had a really nice, long, slow dinner, which was fun. Thank you. Appreciate that. On this podcast, we highlight patient-oriented evidence that matters, or POEMS. If you want all of the POEMS, subscribe to Essential Evidence, where you get a POEM daily, plus a great primary care reference with over 800 disease and symptom chapters and thousands of interactive decision support tools. Check it out at essentialevidenceplus.com. The opinions expressed on Primary Care Update are those of the commentators, and this podcast doesn't represent medical advice or the endorsement of any product. Since it's been a few weeks since we discussed COVID, this week we will talk a little bit about testing for the disease. We're going to talk about children and adolescents and their experience and whether a vaccine will stop the pandemic and symptom duration after contracting COVID. You can now get free CME credit from the Illinois Academy of Family Physicians for listening to the podcast. Just go to iafp.mclms.net to claim it. By way of disclosure, Henry and I are paid by Wiley as editorial consultants to write the POEMS and other content for Essential Evidence Plus, but we're not paid to do this podcast. So we're going to start off with a couple of POEMS about testing for COVID. The first one is
So hang on to your hats, folks, because this is going to be a little technical section here. So stick with us.
Yeah, more numbers than we'd normally like to do. And I wish I could show you the graph that I'm looking at on the podcast. But this is a study from Annals of Internal Medicine 2020. By Kuchurka, Lauer, and Leyendecker. And it was, they took data from 7 studies that evaluated the accuracy of reference laboratory PCR for detecting SARS-CoV-2 at different points in time with respect to the infection and symptom onset. And each of these studies took multiple measurements over time. So they might check a patient on day 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on. They fitted the data to a very fancy Bayesian hierarchical logistic regression model, and then used it to estimate the false negative rate, so the missed cases by day of infection. So the false negative rate starts at 100%. You're not going to detect anybody in the first few days after exposure and infection. It starts going down around day 3 and 4 to 70%, then 40%. It bottoms out around 20%. So you're going to have that corresponds to 80% sensitivity for the first 5 days or so of symptoms, but then it starts rising steadily as the viral shedding decreases to 50% by day 21. So the bottom line is that timing matters, and if a patient is highly suspicious for COVID-19 on or shortly after symptom onset, but the test is negative, repeat the test a day or two later. On the other hand, if you do PCR, and which is highly specific, if it's positive, there's absolutely no need to repeat the test to confirm it. You are likely to be misled by a false negative result if that second test is negative. Now, if the initial test was a rapid antigen test, which we're going to talk about next, then confirming it with PCR might make sense. Guys, what do you think?
Well, I was shocked, I have to say. I thought the sensitivity, at least on the symptom onset day, would be, say, 90%. So I was really amazed that even on day one of symptoms, if you test and you get a negative test, it's pretty unreliable that you need to retest a couple days later. So this was very instructive for me.
Henry?
Yeah, so I'm a little bit confused, and maybe that's just my usual state of being. But so the title for this was PCR sensitivity declines over time, and you know I usually think of test characteristics of sensitivity and specificity as unique and stable properties of a test. So what this is suggesting either that there is some form of spectrum bias, or is this really an issue of viral load and thresholds? Because we know that the viral load early is very different than it is when you start to become symptomatic. Mark, any clarity on that?
Yeah, I think that's clearly what's going on, is that the viral load is peaking around the time of symptom onset, maybe a little bit before. And by 7 days, the viral load has declined significantly. If you look at the PCR cycle times, which is basically a higher cycle time, means you have to run the PCR longer, in my very simple way of thinking about it, more cycles to detect any virus. So if that number is above 30 or 35, that means you have to do a lot of work to find a little tiny bit of virus. And so you get to that 30, 35 range at about 7 days. Other studies have shown that. So, you know, by 7 days, you're starting to lose the ability to detect the virus. So, yeah, I think that's what's going on.
Part of the problem, though, must be taking specimens, because it's no fun to have one of those swabs put up your nose. And so you've got to be fairly aggressive, I would think, at taking a swab in order to make sure you get some virus in it.
Yeah, and some of it could have to do with how the sample is prepared. Some of the machines, some of the point of care recommend a dry swab rather than you putting it into a viral transport medium, which normally you wouldn't do that anyway if you're doing a point of care PCR, like one of the Abbott or Cepheid tests. So yeah, there's a lot of moving parts, and we're going to talk about those tests in our next segment. So moving on, our next segment, this is a Cochrane review. We tend to think of Cochrane as doing treatment meta-analyses, but they've dipped their toe in the diagnostic space. And this is by a really good group. John Deeks is one of the key investigators, and he's done a lot of systematic reviews and is a real expert on diagnostic systematic reviews. And this was in Cochrane, published August 26, 2020. So they identified all the published and preprint studies that they could find that compared either a rapid antigen test or a point-of-care molecular test to reference laboratory PCR, which was the reference standard or gold standard. Specificity was evaluated using pre-pandemic stored samples. So they found somebody who couldn't possibly have had COVID-19 because it didn't exist yet, and they found those samples and then got the specificity that way. This is not good news for rapid antigen tests. The average sensitivity that they found was only 56%. The specificity was very good for those tests, 99.5%, but the sensitivity means you're going to miss a lot of patients who actually are infected. With regards to the point-of-care rapid PCR test, there are two that they looked at, the Abbott ID Now, which is actually what's used at the White House, and the Cepheid Expert, I think it's Gene Expert Express. Cepheid is C-E-P-H-E-I-D. And it really matters which test you're using in terms of how you interpret it and how you use that information. The Abbott ID Now was actually significantly less sensitive than the Cepheid, 77% versus 99.4%. So it missed almost a quarter of patients who were infected. But it was a little more specific, 99.6% versus 96.8%. So a true positive, a positive was more likely to truly be positive. At a 10%, if overall 10% of patients being tested are positive, that corresponds to a positive predictive value of 96% for the ID Now versus only 77% for the expert, the Cepheid Expert Express. So that means that you can believe a positive from the Cepheid test, but maybe not so much from from the Abbott test, but not so much from the Cepheid test. too many numbers. So the negative predictive value, which, can we exclude this person? Can we say that they're safe, like to visit the president, let's say? The negative predictive value was 97% for the Abbott, 100% for the Cepheid. So if you want to protect someone important, like say the president, you'd use the Cepheid test, which is highly sensitive and has a great negative predictive value. If someone's negative, they really are negative and non-infectious, you wouldn't use the Abbott test, but that's the one they used at the White House, which could explain the super spreader event that happened and some of the widespread infections in the White House, because they used the wrong test. Basically, I don't know why. I think, you know, maybe there are politics involved. The Abbott test is quicker. It's 15 minutes instead of 40, but that seems like, you know, maybe not the best decision. Henry, what do you think?
So I've got a couple of points. The first is that the Cochrane has spent several years trying to work out the methods, both the searching methods, the quality ratings, and the statistical methods for doing diagnostic systematic reviews. And so it should be no surprise that it's taken them a while to actually start to generate those reviews, because this is still methodology that's relatively new. And the second point that I want to make is that, and it's true for all tests, okay, and not necessarily specific to COVID-19, you have to know what you're trying to accomplish with the test itself. Are you trying to rule in a condition? Or are you trying to rule out a condition? And then your selection of tests ought to be based on the positive and negative likelihood ratios. And then when you get the result, you can't interpret the results unless you have some idea of what was the likelihood of the disease before you ever order the test. And to me, that's probably the most important points when we start to review these kinds of studies.
John.
I would point out that there are some nice charts and graphs accompanying these two studies that Mark presented. And although you can't see them now, if you go to the Illinois Academy website for CME, we do provide a copy of most of the text, at least of the abstracts that we present. So you will be able to see the table. So I would recommend you consider doing that. That'd be a little extra that you'll get. And the CME is free.
Excellent. Great advice. I didn't realize you were doing that. That's really good. And I'm going to try to work also a little bit more on updating, making the show notes a little more comprehensive. And so if you're in iTunes, you can just hit more. I think it's more information, and it'll show you more detailed show notes. So John has the quiz this week, not Henry. John, take it away.
Here is a fun question about the history of human pandemics, or plagues, as we used to call them. Here we go. Rank the following pandemics in terms of estimated number of deaths. First, we have COVID-19, then Spanish flu, smallpox, bubonic plague, and HIV/AIDS. So I've given you five pandemics: COVID, Spanish flu, smallpox, bubonic plague, HIV/AIDS. And we will give you the answer in a bit about which caused the most deaths by rank order.
Stay tuned. Henry, you're going to talk a little bit about the experience of children and adolescents in terms of infectivity and susceptibility.
Thank you. But I did want to as John was describing the quiz, for some reason, Monty Python and the Holy Grail just came to mind. So ghoulish thoughts. I'm sorry. Maybe it's the Halloween season. All right. So this first study is a limited systematic review. They only searched PubMed, a preprint server, and a public health website. And I think that their search was too constrained, frankly. They were looking for studies that reported contact tracing or the prevalence of proven COVID-19 in children and adolescents. And they also had to include secondary infection rates. And the reason I think this is a little problematic is because they were really trying to answer two separate questions. One question was, are children and adolescents more susceptible to contracting COVID? And then the second, if they are infected, are they more likely to transmit the virus? So it's possible that they may have missed important studies had they tried to do a search on each of these questions singly. In any case, they ended up with 32 studies with just under 42,000 children and adolescents, and those studies also included about 250,000 adults. Half the studies looked at contact tracing or school-based, and 14 of them were population-based. When they looked at the quality of the studies, only two, and both of those were population-based, were thought to be high quality. So when they tried to pool all of those data and compare it to adults, what they found was that the chances of a child or an adolescent becoming infected was just over half that for an adult. And they found a lot of variability in the data, and they tried to take into account things like study quality and the age, but still found a lot of variability in the data. And that shouldn't be terribly surprising because they can't take into account differential testing strategies, the timing of things, or even the possibility that we've completely ignored children and adolescents for the first several months of the trial because we thought they weren't likely to become infected. Now, they looked at, found three studies that were of medium quality that were school-based contact tracing, and they only had 36 index cases of children that they traced and couldn't find any evidence of child-to-adult transmission, but that's only based on 36 cases. So bottom line, I think they're probably right, although the details in terms of the level of risk is maybe not quite right. But I think children and adolescents are less susceptible, but we really can't draw any conclusions about their ability to infect others. So like many things that we've learned in this epidemic, this pandemic, we should proceed with an abundance of caution.
Thanks, Henry. And you were also going to tell us a little bit in the next one about vaccines, and then we can discuss.
Okay, yes. So this paper was sent to us by our friend Bill Wadland, who is an editor for the American Journal of Preventive Medicine. And this would probably not have been on our radar screen had he not sent it to us. So thank you, Bill. So we're still waiting for an effective vaccine against COVID. And this paper tried to figure out, is a vaccine enough to stop the pandemic and what would it take? So they used a computer model similar to the London models, the Imperial College of London that we've heard about in the past. And they tried to figure out how effective must the vaccine be and what proportion of residents would need to take the vaccine in order to reduce transmission to stop the pandemic itself. And after all of their statistical jiu-jitsu and gymnastics, they determined that to stop the current pandemic, the vaccine would have to be at least 60% effective if everybody in the U.S. took it. And we know that's not likely to happen. So they go on and talk about, well, what would be reasonable levels of effectiveness? And it's a various combinations of uptake and vaccine effectiveness. So they felt that bottom line, it should be at least 80% effective, and about 3/4 of people should take the vaccine in order for this to have any meaningful impact. And so, since I think these are unlikely thresholds, that means that we probably still need to include the social distancing and wearing of masks and hand washing in order for us to really put a stop to this.
Yeah, I think it's going to be very regional, Henry. I think we're going to see probably high uptake in some communities and low uptake in others. And, you know, kind of like we see with lots of other vaccines like measles, where you might have 50% in one community vaccinated versus 98% in another. So it might end up being somewhat regional. It might end up being, there might be other factors that we don't know about. But yeah, it's a little... gives you pause because we all think, oh, when we get a vaccine, we're all going to be good. But that's only if people use it. John?
I think it's going to be a while. I think that COVID epidemic is going to end and maybe in a year or so, but then it becomes endemic. That means there will be a constant lower rate of infection. So COVID-19 is not going away anytime soon.
Yeah, I think there's no way people are going to maintain this level of caution long term. I think that they may change some habits. I think there was one study that showed people are much more likely to wash their hands after coming home from the market or from being outside. And you know, things like that will probably continue. I don't know that mask wearing, other than maybe on public transit or in airplanes, is going to continue long term. But, you know, we'll see. We'll see. John, you were going to finish us off with talking about the long haulers, I guess.
Yes, I was surprised by the results of this study. There have been TV broadcasts about cases of people with persistent symptoms for months, but here's some data. This report is from one hospital in France and describes persistent symptoms in patients who had mild to moderate symptoms of COVID-19 during the initial illness. So these are not the really sick patients. Persistent symptoms were defined as weight loss of greater than 5%, severe shortness of breath or fatigue, chest pain, palpitations, trouble with smelling or tasting, headache, skin signs, arthralgias, myalgias, digestive symptoms, fever, or sick leave. There were 293 patients who presented to this hospital during the study period, and of those, 150 had mild to moderate symptoms, which meant they weren't admitted to the ICU, they weren't nursing home residents, and they didn't die. And the data was available 30 days follow-up for phone call and medical records review. 130 of these 150 were still available at day 60 to follow up. Here are the results. At day 30, 69% of patients had at least one persistent symptom. And at day 60, 66% of the 130 had persistent symptoms. At day 30, 28% had alterations of taste and smell, 37% had shortness of breath, and 50% had significant fatigue. At day 60, 23% had alterations of taste or smell, 30% had shortness of breath, and 40% had persistent fatigue. And more than one-third said that they still felt sick or felt worse at day 60 compared to the initial phase of the illness. So people talk about, well, you know, I didn't die, but I think a lot of people forget that this can be, for many people, a persistent illness that takes at least a couple of months for symptoms to resolve. So those who say, oh, I don't care if I get infected, I don't think that's a wise position. Henry?
So this tells me that if you were symptomatic after a month, you're just as likely to be symptomatic at 2 months. And that whatever symptoms you had at the end of a month, they're going to be, those are the same symptoms you're likely to be living with at the end of that. So that to me was one piece of information. And, you know, this was a French study from a single hospital. And I think the most important thing, because we've talked about this before in light of individuals who have had severe infections, people who were hospitalized and the like, and that these are very similar, but the patients had mild to moderate disease. And so this tells me that the experience of the severely ill may not be the deconditioning and other things that we thought they were during our previous discussions, but this is a unique issue of the virus itself.
Yeah, this is, I was really surprised by this one. This was particularly the mild to moderate. I guess I'd like to know a little bit more about how mild or how moderate it was. These were not admitted to the ICU, but I think, were they admitted? I think they were all admitted to hospital.
No, some of them were outpatients, some of them were admitted. So no, it was not all hospitalized patients.
Yeah. Okay. Well, certainly it'll be interesting to see, you know, we know other viral infections like mono that can cause symptoms that persist for even in some studies, 2 to 6 months in a minority of patients. Maybe I'm a little bit reassured that there was some improvement between day 30 and 60, but I'll be curious to see what happens with 3 or 6 months of follow-up. Thanks for that. Very interesting. And we're going to have an answer to the quiz now from John.
Yes, there's a short piece called Visualizing the History of Pandemics, written by Nicholas Lepan, which was published online March 14th, 2020, and gives a wonderful pictorial summary of pandemics throughout the history of mankind. Here are the rankings of the deadliest pandemics.
Drum roll, number one,
please. Number one, as you're not surprised, is the Black Death or the bubonic plague of the 14th century. It's hands down the winner with an estimated 200 million deaths. Number two is the New World smallpox epidemic that started around 1520, and that ranks second with a distant 56 million deaths. Number three, the Spanish flu, third, with somewhere between 40 and 50 million deaths, so it's a close third. Next is HIV/AIDS, which ranks a close fourth at 25 to 35 million deaths, and COVID-19, at least so far, is a distant fifth with 1 million deaths. Now, I didn't mention the plague of Justinian in the 6th century. Most of us haven't heard of that one. It was another bubonic plague caused by Yersinia pestis, and it was also devastating, killing 30 to 50 million people. So it was a biggie, too. In addition to the Black Plague of the 14th century and the Plague of Justinian, there have been four other major plagues caused by that nasty bug, which is transported by rats and fleas. If you want to learn more, go to visualcapitalist.com. That's visualcapitalist.com, and then search on the word pandemic.
So before Henry gives his art or literary recommendation, I want to say we made a reference to Monty Python and the Holy Grail, and some of our listeners, if you're anything like my doctoral students, have no idea what we're talking about.
Oh, gosh.
And so it's one of the greatest movies ever made. And there's a scene where you just go to YouTube and search Monty Python, Bring Out Your Dead, and look for the place where there's where the old woman is swinging a cat to beat a rug. That's my favorite part of it. Cat lovers, send all your hate mail to johnhickner at gmail.com. We'll read all of them, we promise. And so I'll let Henry go on with his recommendation.
Yeah, so before I do that, I just reflect a little bit that these pandemics have had major impact in terms of history. So the bubonic plague of the 14th century that wiped out so many people in around the world, it took close to 200 years for the population to come back to the pre-bubonic plague levels. And it's thought that the plague of Justinian contributed mightily to the downfall of the Roman Empire. So these are things that we should not take lightly. So my literary recommendation was triggered by listening to the White House physician last week. And I don't know what it made me think about that, but it's Pope Brock's 2008 book called Charlatan. There are two stories in the book. One part is Morris Fishbein, who some of us olders remember as the legendary editor for the journal JAMA, but his early career was working for the American Medical Association investigating quackery. The second part, and the dominant part of the book, evaluates the life of John Brinkley. John Brinkley claimed to be a physician, and he first became famous by trying to restore the virility to farmers by implanting old goat testicles into the men. And then the story gets weird. So,
oh boy,
yeah. So there's a documentary that premiered a few years ago called Nuts that was based on this, and I think probably the one of the things that was really important about Brinkley was that he managed to somehow stay just a few steps ahead of Boris Fishbein and the FBI. He had no lack of chutzpah and has to be one of the most colorful quacks in history.
Thanks, Henry. Check that out, the movie Nuts or Monty Python and the Holy Grail. And so I hope you enjoyed today's discussion. Please tell your friends. If you're on iTunes, you can email this podcast to folks or a link to it. There's an email button that you can use. That's a great way to let your friends who are maybe fellow primary care physicians know about us if you want to inflict us on them. The Illinois Academy of Family Physicians, or IAFP, is accredited by the ACCME to provide CME for physicians. The IAFP designates this internet enduring activity for a maximum of 0.5 AMA PRA Category 1 credits. The IAFP adheres to the conflict of interest policy for the ACCME and the AMA. It's the policy of the Illinois Academy of Family Physicians to ensure balance, independence, objectivity, and scientific rigor in all of its educational activities. So have a great day, iafp.mclms.net, and we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks with more primary care updates.